This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
JazzCast Pros.
Welcome back to the Igniting Hope podcast show, brought to you by the Buffalo Center for Health Equity. I am your host, Ebony White, just coming to you with what is happening in our very own community and all across the country. In this 30-minute time span, we are going to cover a great deal of information, and I hope that you will stay with us for all 30 minutes. So let's quickly get started. I'm really excited to bring our guest today is Dion Green, the founder and CEO of Fudge Foundation in Dayton, Ohio. Hello, Dion. How are you?
I'm doing well. Hello, Ebony. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I know we're going to cover a lot of information. And for our listeners and viewers, whatever time of the day you choose to listen, you might want to make sure you have a pen and pad next to you to take down all this vital information.
Once again, my name is Dion Green. I'm from Dayton, Ohio. I'm a black man in this country. Proud father and still a proud son. Grew up in Springfield, Ohio, to my mother, Denise Green. I have another sibling. Me and her share the same moms, but I was my father's only child. Had a pretty hard life growing up, but I never let those barriers or roadblocks stop me in moving forward in my life. Ended up attending school, getting my bachelor's and master's in business, and I'm currently attending school again to get my second master's in social work. That nobody told me to say, Dion, just stop. But, I'm one
of
the people. I know. I'm one of the people that once you start, I can't stop. So, and this is something that is needed in our communities. We need more black men in that field because there's very few. There's very few. So not only for me, I'm doing it for other black boys and other black men in the country to encourage and inspire to move forward in this field because there's so many of us that need help, but there's not a lot of us that look like us to help us. Just trying to break that stigma.
That's very true. Tell us about the Fudge Foundation. What brought you to the point of establishing that foundation? And what are the missions and the goals?
So what really created my foundation was through pain and through denial. And the pain comes from August 4th, 2019, a mass shooter walked down the side of a building onto a popular entertainment district in Dayton, Ohio, and opened fire on the sidewalk and in the streets. One of the people that he killed that night just happened to be my father, Derek Fudge, that was standing beside me, along with his sister in front of me and seven others. That night was an unbearable night. It replays in my head every day, whether my eyes are closed or open. I have a visual aspect of that night every time it comes to my memory. But what made me create my foundation was the denial part, where people that was impacted, family members that lost loved ones, were being denied help from the state of Ohio due to a bill called VOCA. And VOCA is in every state in the United States. It's a little pocket of funds that are in the Attorney General office that are for people that have been impacted by violent crime to apply for burial expenses, jobs, if you're missing work, counseling, all types of things. But the restrictions on being able to receive those funds and the barriers that are in front of on that application to even move forward is just ridiculous. And I was just one of the families and one of the survivors that was denied that help from the state of Ohio due to my father being 9 years and 6 months clean of not being in trouble, and you had to be 10 years. So that right there was what made me create my foundation, because I started advocating in the state house on how that bill sucks. He didn't ask to die. And we are the ones that are still here living through that pain every day, being reminded because we feel the void of our loved ones. You know, some people don't have insurance. Some people do. But they shouldn't have to worry about how to bury their loved ones and how to move forward on in life. So I challenged that bill in the State House in 2020. As we was moving forward, it was passing through the Senate. But then the one bill that passed all throughout the United States, Stand Your Ground, came into session. So I started fighting that. So that year, VOCA got pushed back. Then we went back at it again, and it got passed in 2022. And the revise was just perfect. It went back 3 years retroactive for when the shooting happened. So anybody that survived, that got denied hospital payments or stuff like that, could reapply for those funds. Plus, it took all the restrictions off.
So you were talking about some of the restrictions. So can you, I know you kind of discussed about you couldn't have a criminal history or be a felon and having at least 10 years from having any contact, and the barriers that poses on our Black and Brown communities. What were some of the other restrictions that were laid out in that bill specifically?
Thank you for asking, because there's a lot. So say, Ebony, you're riding in a car with me and somebody takes my life, and you apply for the VOCA. If you don't assist the police with their investigation or give them the information they want to know, you will be denied. But see, what they don't understand is that retaliation is real.
Okay.
And once we give you that information, are you going to protect that person? So that got taken off. Also, there was a one good friend, her name was Elena, that was shot. She was on Ritalin's or something like that was in her system, and they denied her, and that was her actual medication.
Oh my gosh. So you're trying to tell me that this young woman that you were speaking of was criminalized for a medication in which she was prescribed to take for various health reasons, and that was another penalty of her not receiving the support that she needed.
Correct.
So with all of the, so how did, even though you discussed about going to the Senate and pushing against that bill, what were the modifications? Like, what were the proposals? Did you play that key role in advocating for rewriting that legislation?
When I first got introduced to it, she's not in office no more because she termed out, but it was Senator Peggy Lehner here that represent the Centerville district here. And she reached out to me, and I had a meeting with her, and just to hear her efforts and want to change this, because so many people was being affected. Like, we are the ones that are still here. Yes, we miss our loved ones, but for those that can't get the mental health help, because they don't have insurance or this and that, it's needed, because without that help, the cycle of that is, it goes to everything. So like, for instance, like for me at the beginning, my alcohol intake went up. You know, I was coping in a negative way. When these things happen, we don't care about mail. We don't care about nothing in the world. We're just trying to make it through every day and not understanding how we're making it through. But the next step that I can push on, these are not me, but these are examples. So my alcohol intake goes up. I'm not looking at bills. So now, I'm in a chance of losing my home, becoming homeless. But my alcohol intake went up, but it's not really helping no more. So now I move to harder drugs. So now I'm having a substance abuse problem. But now I'm on harder drugs. I have no money. Now for me to get money, I have to commit a crime. So the circles of life without getting that proper treatment for that mental health. And we know that these things are going to surface someday, somehow. And just to be able to make sure that resources are there for those that are needed directly or indirectly are available. And I was proud to see that Ohio was the change agent of that, to move that forward. And also, you know, try to work on that across the country, because so many people need these resources. But the main thing about it is a lot of people don't even know these things exist. So I have to bring awareness about that.
You discussed so much, and everything that you touched is environmental, you know, our social determinants of our health that is systemically in place. But when you add substance abuse, you add trauma, you add depression, you add all of those layers, you're like, how do I get out of this cycle?
You seem like you're constantly drowning.
Fair, fair. You and I met and crossed paths because we share an unfortunate traumatic collision of violence and white supremacy and terrorism on our loved ones in our community at large. So what has come out of this constant, and the sad part is, it's not normal, right? But it happens so frequently.
It's becoming normal.
That people feel like it's normal. It's just another situation. This is not normal.
We cannot normalize this.
And what has come out of the White House is the first ever gun violence prevention. So for me, it has been, you know, approaching 2 years in May, but it just never gets easier. So you already shared how you kind of thrown yourself into making a difference, being the difference that is so necessary. When it comes to the White House gun violence prevention, how that office itself, how have you interfaced with that office? I know most recently you had the opportunity to go to Washington, but for what you can share, would you?
Well, you know, first let me commend the leadership for the OVGP, Greg Jackson and Rob Wilcox, just to be brave enough to even step up in that position when we know at a time this issue feels like racism because it creates separation. So for them to even step up in that position to be a voice and fight this good old fight, I commend them on that. So thank you, Greg and Rob. But yeah, ever since my shooting, I travel across the country to all the mass shooting sites to work with the families and the communities impacted. Just first off, showing up and being a support, especially when the shootings like ours are more Black and brown and people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're seen, but we're not heard. And so I have to let them know that they're not alone, because when I went through mines, I was alone. I didn't know what was next. I learned through failure. I just learned through moving and loving on the next person. And just is my dog barking loud?
You think he'll be fine?
But just showing up and being a shoulder and an ear for them to lean on and to listen in a moment like that is just something crucial, because I didn't have that. So, and I know the type of pressure that it takes off, because usually when I go to those places, I usually tell people, just love on your family. Let mm-hmm. your family love on you, because, you know, you got media, you got this. I mean, they got us trying to do a funeral in the midst of trying to figure out what just really happened. So we're here, there, everywhere. So I try to take much burden off of a person and just say, let your family love on you. I would do the footwork until I need your John Hancock or till you are needed. Because we know when our loved ones are around and when the funeral all hasn't took place, we are so empowered by our family. But the real fight starts when everybody leaves. So I need them to know that they're not alone, because when these things happen, these crisis centers come, they set up. So, you know, it's FBI agents, it's other organizations from across the country that are just there for a moment. And as we said, they want us to process our trauma like a car wash. They just want you to run it in and run it out and get back on the road like nothing ever happened.
And you know what? When you say that's exactly what it felt like, almost rushed. And that's not true, because there was really, for me, it was a moment that I just needed for it to be quiet, because everything was so much noise that you can't really even hear at all, because you're literally in shock for, you know, days on end, months on end, trying to figure out. And most of the things you're doing on autopilot. And what you speak about, you know, everyone kind of came in, helicoptered in, flew in. And then when you are ready, Some were gone, if not most were gone.
Pretty much all, until it was the community that, the real community that was still there. So that's right. Why I show up to let them know, like, hey, you don't have to share your story with me, because I know you just probably shared it 18 times in that crisis center because you keep getting pushed along to the next person. I know what you've been through. I'm here. I'm a support for life. As long as I got air in my lungs, I'm always a phone call, a text message, an email away. And if you are able, not saying you will be because we all grieve and heal differently, but if you want to advocate in mental health, if you want to advocate against gun violence, if you want to advocate in the community, hey, I know this organization that does this. I know this organization that does this. Oh, you need some peer support? I know they do this. So we're a resource for life, and we're not there for the moment. We're there for life.
So you're doing a great deal of referral and linkage and a little bit of coaching. So what does your team consist of?
So my village is social workers.
Okay.
You know, that's why I'm back in school again. They pushed me through the door. You're right. And that's what a leader does. They inspire. And I'm happy. My collaboration is across the country. You know, when I chime in and go to places, there might be other organizations say, hey, Dion, if they need this, I'm here. Because they know I'm there. They know I'm at ground zero. Plus, they're also checking on me because they know I'm putting myself right back in the day one.
Right.
You know, people. Right. I think people tend to forget because I got on this mission to fight. But I think they forget that I'm fighting for real inside internally as well, because I'm just as hurt as them as well. You know, mm-hmm. but I'm trying to be hope to them in a hopeless atmosphere. You know, because it does get dark, and it does really get dark in communities like ours where we really are seen and never heard. When I was just there at the forum, that panel, just hearing the things y'all are experiencing, I had to look around to say, like, am I in Dayton?
It felt like the same thing. Like, it's so similar. So that's how you know it's systemic. Right?
It's a structure.
It's a structure. It's a system that operates the way it's supposed to operate. And we're feeling what, unfortunately, the system wants us to feel.
Broken.
By what has been imposed on us. This is just so rich, but I want to give our listeners also the opportunity to hear about your write-in campaign that's happening in Ohio House District number 39, where you are running against the incumbent, Phil Plummer. What brought you to this place? So number one, you said, hey, you know what? I figured out I have something to offer still. Even despite what has happened to me, I'm going to establish this foundation. Two, I'm going to not only with this foundation take care of the people in Dayton, Ohio, but I'm going to travel abroad and support all of the communities and the people in those communities with the support that they need during these trying times. Then on top of that, I'm going to be involved in what is happening in this first ever gun violence prevention office in our very own country, in the White House. I'm going to put my eyes to that. On top of that, you know what? I'm going to finish this education too, because I want to have all of the tools essential for me to fulfill and get my community to the place I want them to get to that place, not just having the hope, but being able to arrive at what they were expecting and hoping for. That now you're going to run. You're running a write-in campaign. Why have you jumped on board with that piece as well?
Man, I wake up every day and look in the mirror and say, Dion, what are you doing? And then some days I say, why not? You know, I've been asked this question for years, and I kept saying, I'm not ready. I don't know nothing about that. Then I woke up one day and said, when would you ever be? So my motto is like Nike, just do it. You already lead with love. You already lead in spaces that you're intentional. You're already leading. So why not establish a space in your state capital to give the community a real voice to offer hope, bring healing and progress, to see us together forge a path towards resilience and a thriving community. So I prayed on it and I just stepped up into it. But also, I'm just so tired of seeing our leaders in those positions. Thank you for your leadership. But sometimes, like all things, things expire. Things evolved. And if it takes me to try to break the cycle to encourage our youth, because our youth is what really our country is about to be, but we have to show them like, hey, you can do this. Whether if you don't know what you're doing or not, when you got other real leaders behind you, they're going to be with you the whole step. But first, we got to encourage them and make them feel valuable. Like, hey, I'm a run for office. Because when you start looking at these sheets and you see the incumbents, then you see the candidates, you see very few of them on that right side. And it's just like, hey, what are we doing? And I understand that, you know, for our youth and probably some for our older folks, it just seemed like it's the same old thing every time. So if we're seeing it's the same old thing, let's break that cycle. Let's shake it up. You know, I don't care if you got $5 in your campaign. Put your name up there. You know, as me and you on this call and I say, hey, I'm a run for president. And we just talking. And we get off the phone, off the call, and I never run. But now I go up, I go foul and do this and that. That's action. That's a small step of action. A lot of people sit in rooms and say what they're going to do, or a lot of people sit in meetings and say this is what they're going to do. Then when you come back to the following meeting, nothing got done. So just for me to get up, go downtown and foul and put myself out there was already a win to me.
That's an amazing point, because you talked about not just talking about it, but understanding that there's some actionable steps that have to happen in our pursuit, and not just accepting what we've been receiving and just saying like, listen, if I want some change, I'm at least going to stand up and get in the running.
Right.
I have to get in the running, and it takes courage to say that and not feel like I have to shrink. Because sometimes, like you already said, well, maybe I don't have what it takes, and then we self-doubt talk. You know, we doubt ourselves and our capabilities.
That's another systemic structure, because we're not supposed to be astronauts or lawyers, so we self-doubt ourselves.
Right. We do this self-doubt, right? And we talk ourselves down and we shrink into places and spaces of, unfortunately, mediocrity. When the truth of the matter is, we are more than capable. And you spoke about the village that has wrapped themselves around you and supported you in being able to do that. And that's huge. And that's amazing. So I'm excited for you and what you're doing there in Dayton, Ohio. But I want to kind of move to what you're going to come here to Buffalo and do. You have agreed to just come be with us for our Gun Violence Prevention Youth Conference that is scheduled in February 29th, actually. All the details you can find directly on our website and any of our social media handles as well. So how do you think us taking our stories, our tales of these two stories and the stories that you have from the travel across the country, how do you think collectively these stories together, and along with not just the stories, which is a cultural thing, our storytelling, that's how we communicate with one another, but how do you think that's going to impact our solution of moving forward in these spaces to bring a heightened awareness that this is a public health issue? It is not just a Black and brown thing. This is violence. It's violence on mankind. In our city, it was an attack on African Americans, purposefully looking for and being extremely apologetic for even injuring someone who was not African American. And in all of the other cities that this kind of terrorism has occurred, it's closing in. So it's just, so when we start talking about gun violence and gun prevention and access and all of those other things that's happening, how do you think us bridging and working collectively will have an overall impact on what we want to see and policy and advocacy and legislation?
Well, first and foremost, can't nothing get done without collaboration. We have to all sit at the table and have those uncomfortable conversations, whether it's law enforcement, this and that, to be able to move forward. But I think the advocacy of us steady sharing our stories, sharing what we have experienced then, now, but also what we're still seeing in our communities from the systemic structure part of it, from schools, from easy access to guns, to people that are elevated at high risk of violence, to poverty, to underfunded public houses. Like, we have to sit down and figure out a collective on how can we bring hope back to our community, you know, because they're really hopeless and they're seeing crime. And, you know, there was a lady that I just had to respond to today in a message just saying, you know, these kids are doing this and that. They shouldn't give a second chance. I said, ma'am, you don't know their upbringing. This might be the only thing they have ever seen in their life. So they were a product of my environment. But while you're sitting here texting and asking that, won't you call the juvenile detention center group homes and see how you can help? People always got so much to say, but never want to step up and be a part of the change. So if you're not doing nothing, but you're talking, you're part of the problem. And I'm getting so tired of that. People always have something to say, but they don't want to be a part of the solution.
Right. They keep in score. They keep score right. of all of the negative things, but not looking at how they could definitely change the trajectory.
And the gun violence that are plaguing our communities, man, when you start looking at the statistics, it's like the age is getting younger and younger and younger. And it just hurts my heart because these kids haven't experienced life. They're making choices that's putting themselves in prison or in the ground. So, you know, listen to them. But as I always say, sometimes we need to sit back and hear what their problems are, because we always tend to think we have the solutions.
They have the answers.
Because when I speak with a lot of my youth at work too, you know, the main thing they always say what their problem is, what I say don't mean nothing. So basically, they don't feel value or their words don't carry weight. So it's like we have to give them the platform and a voice. Because they know it. Can we help? Yes. But, and I'm guilty of this, we all are, that we will have the solution to their problems and really don't even know what their problem is. So I think it's to really share what we've been through, see some of the things, ask them questions, and let them narrate the whole topic of what does it look like without gun violence and how can we address it. And they will give us some key components on what we need to address because they live it. They're in it.
Mm-hmm.
I was somewhere and I just heard another youth, powerful youth, just say, like, the older leaders think our voices don't matter. And that just dawned on me. Like, wow.
So first, I want to thank you for all of your insight and your bravery and just how you have put yourself out there for the benefit, not just for yourself, but everybody around you, for people to see that there is still life to be lived.
Amen.
After surviving a horrendous act of violence like that. And I think what you talked about is, are you saying they don't hear me? Sometimes we impose on them what has been imposed on us. So we discuss how sometimes you don't hear me, but then you don't see me. So how invisible we've created. Sometimes they feel invisible in these spaces. And we want to make sure that they know we can see them and we can hear them. And we want to take the guidance from them to have a greater understanding of the strategy about how to go forward and really improve the longevity and the quality of their lives.
That's what it's about. Like, I'm excited to be there because I'm going to be the student absorbing everything they're saying.
Mm-hmm. And we're excited to have you and just be able to hear from our young people. So my final thought for our viewers and listeners alike: take some time, if there are some young people around you, in your midst that are in your care, under your watch, make sure that you can see them and hear them. And until next time, this is the Igniting Hope podcast, brought to you by the Buffalo Center for Health Equity. And we'll see you next time. Thank you.